It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A-plus Schools, which advocates for equity in Pittsburgh public schools, has issued its annual report calling for the community to reckon with the legacy of what it calls the American caste system in education. James Fogarty is the executive director of A-plus Schools. James, welcome back to the confluence.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Caste system, that's a bleak assessment. What specifically do you mean by that?
Ingrained hierarchies that exist in our communities that are based on race in many ways. And so really wanted to awaken people to this idea that we have kind of a two-tiered system that starts as early as kindergarten for our children. And there are lots of factors, some in school, many outside of school, that impact that. And I wanted folks to wake up and reckon with this idea that we've created these false hierarchies that are harming the promise of our young children, especially Black and brown children in our communities.
How does that play out in terms of opportunity and achievement?
We look at first, who's showing up to school, and you see a disparity even as early as kindergarten between Black and white students, right? And so you see chronic absence rates for Black students being three times as high as for white students in our district. The other thing we do is we start to identify which children are gifted in our schools at a very young age, right? As early as kindergarten and first grade. And typically the evaluation for that giftedness is based on a teacher recommendation saying, hey, your child seems to have some gifts here that we should find out and get them a gifted individualized education plan, or a GIEP, as it's called. Well, that GIEP, once you get it, you don't lose it. Even though we know intelligence is malleable, how we evaluate and assess that at young ages, if you look at the data in Pittsburgh public schools, means that kids that are coming from higher resourced households are much more likely to be labeled gifted. And based on our history of segregation, you end up seeing that most of the kids, and it's about 66% of the kids that get identified as gifted in Pittsburgh public schools, are white in a district that's 70% kids of color. We start early, right, with this, and then we push kids out at a disproportionate rate, especially young children. Even with a K-2 suspension ban, we still see suspensions, arrests for young children, predominantly Black children in our district, at much higher rates, right? About 80% of the kids 79% last year, the kids that were suspended at least once were Black.
Some of the policies that you allude to in the report, whether it's neighborhood enrollment lines mimicking housing red lines, poverty, that's outside the purview of the city's school district. So are you suggesting solutions go beyond what our school leaders can actually do?
Yes. I mean, I think the shift in my mindset has really been about where we've been kind of so focused on the school as an institution and what happens within the four walls of that school as needing improvement. I do think there are things we can do to organize schools so that they serve the children we have much better. But if we deny the fact that that they exist nested in a society and in a system of laws and frameworks that create challenges for Black and brown children that then they show up to school with, and then our systems have to manage to support them. If we're not talking across silos, we harm kids. I mean, and one of the perfect examples is around housing, right? We see that the kind of shift in where affordable housing is available in the city as certain neighborhoods gentrify means that you create higher mobility. Well, for who, right? The folks most in poverty, right? Who are much more likely to face an eviction. And so they have to move typically in the middle of a school year. Right. And so when you have predominantly Black and brown families who are in poverty in Pittsburgh, who have to move a lot, is it any wonder that the results we see are the results that we get?
James, you do note some bright spots. Pittsburgh Public Schools early childhood program, almost no gaps by race in student achievement by the time students leave pre-K. That's a good thing, but is it almost too late for students in middle and high school where achievement gaps still exist?
Well, no. If you can do it in early childhood, what's to say you can't do it later? And for kids who are far behind, there are examples across the country and even here in Pittsburgh. You know, I point to City High as one example of a place where students come in from with a variety at a variety of levels, and they're able to accelerate learning for all students. We highlight Colfax as a place where, you know, there were big gaps between Black and white students in terms of reading outcomes. And have they been able to close them? Have they closed them wholly? No, but they've been able to close them significantly.
So, James, what is Colfax doing that other schools could do?
One, they're making the standards that the students have to know transparent to students. Not all schools are kind of laying out with clarity, like, you've mastered this skill. You need to be mastering this set of skills by the end of second grade, and we're going to work with you to master this skill, right? So that transparency is creating ownership in the student of, like, what is it that I need to know to be successful by the end of second grade?
James, finally, has the pandemic worsened the disparities? Is there a positive to this, that maybe the pandemic is shining a brighter light on the inequities?
I mean, I don't know if that's positive. I mean, I'm glad that folks are paying attention, but I'm really worried. I'm concerned that we have students who are not able to log in, who are unsupervised and therefore lost. And I will just say this, if you are out and about and you're not wearing a mask, please do. That's my hope, is that we can have a community rally around public health and do the right thing so that kids can get back to school.
James Fogarty is the executive director of A-Plus Schools. Thanks for your time, James.
Of course. Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. President-elect Joe Biden announced his plans to reassert America's commitment to refugees after the Trump administration reduced refugee admissions in the U.S. from 110,000 in 2016 to 15,000 in fiscal year 2021, the lowest on record. What might this policy change mean for local refugee resettlement groups? Leslie Eisenman is the Director of Refugee and Immigrant Services at Jewish Family and Community Services. Leslie, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Leslie, give us a little background. How does your organization assist in the resettlement of refugees who do come to Pittsburgh?
So JFCS was founded in 1937, so over 80 some years ago. And in its beginnings, it was resettling refugees fleeing World War II. Since then, we've been helping groups from around the world of all different religions and nationalities since 2000.
Joe Biden has pledged to, quote, set the annual global refugee admissions cap to 125,000 and to seek to raise it over time, end quote. What might an increase in admitted refugees mean for JFCS and other resettlement groups in Pittsburgh?
Several years ago, we were seeing more and more refugees come. There really was an increase into Pittsburgh in 2010 to about 2016. There was a lot of energy and interest, and we were working on that premise for since 2008. And then we really cut back since 2016. We've been able to have enough refugees come with a smaller staff over the last 4 years.
What does resettlement mean? What does it involve?
All local resettlement agencies are part of the national network. So there are 9 national resettlement networks. Our national network is HIAS. And through HIAS, we are contracted to do the work funded by the State Department and then later on by the Office of Refugee Resettlement to do a series of required steps such as preparing for the refugee arrival, making sure they have safe place to live, furnished place to live. We have some money on their behalf to spend on rent and furniture and phone and bus tickets and some cash. We meet them at the airport. We bring them to their new home. We give them education on life in Pittsburgh. We connect them to myriad services. Refugee adults have to go to work pretty quickly after arrival. The U.S. program is predicated on early economic self-sufficiency. We do a lot of cultural orientation. We find volunteers. We assist with you know, understanding life here. It's usually very different than what they're used to. We use a lot of interns and volunteers, community members, AmeriCorps, plus our professional staff. It's a real whirlwind of activities.
What will it take to ramp up again with this cap being raised?
Well, we would, of course, need to find interpreters in the languages of the people that are coming, and, you know, which is something we would always do, and look at our staffing. This is not something we do without, you know, working with partners. We need housing. Housing is probably the most challenging thing to find. We need to assure that we find for them, and then they later pay on their own, housing that's decent, safe, on a bus line, that they can afford with the money they'll earn in their first jobs in the U.S.
When the Biden administration starts making changes, is there a particular group of refugees who have suffered recently, who desperately need to come here, that you're hoping to welcome to the city?
So in order for anyone to come here, they have to go through a very long process overseas. There are people who've been waiting to travel that were approved over the last few years, or, you know, at some point all these security clearances expire, but there are people ready to travel. So those are that's the first group we'd expect to see. Those could include the friends and family of Congolese refugees who are here, or Burmese or Syrian, Afghani. These are the groups that have been coming, but very small numbers. The delay is going to be, COVID-19 is delaying everything for everyone, but the U.S. program people need to get overseas and do the interviews and process people for the numbers to grow again. So that's going to take some time.
Yeah. Well, speaking of time, I mean, it's all complicated by the pandemic. When Joe Biden is sworn in, he won't be able to magically fix everything in one day, and that's without a pandemic. You work in this field. How long do you think it will take to reverse the changes that occurred during the Trump administration?
Maybe late summer, but definitely the next federal fiscal year, which begins October 1st, 2021, that number will be posted higher than it is now, which it is at 15,000. And just have to see how fast or how slow we can ramp up, keeping everything in mind that people have to be vetted, people have to go through all the security and all the infrastructure that was somewhat dismantled over the last 4 years.
Leslie Eisenman is the Director of Refugee and Immigrant Services at Jewish Family Community Services. Leslie, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, no problem. Thank you very much for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh-based author Maricel Vedda's new novel, The Taste of Sugar, tells the multi-generational story of a Puerto Rican farming family who emigrate to Hawaii at the turn of the 20th century. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll asked Vedda why she chose that story.
Well, I think it has to do that I didn't know my own history of Puerto Rico and where I was in the spectrum of being a Puerto Rican, because I grew up in Chicago, and at home I was Puerto Rican, and sometimes my parents would tell me and my siblings that we were American because of maybe our attitude to them, and maybe we spoke too much English. But when we left our parents' apartment, we were Puerto Rican and too Puerto Rican. And so when I became a fiction writer, that was just something that I was really interested in, figuring out where my family came from, what our stories were. And that's what I researched for my first novel, If I Bring You Roses. I came upon this fact that 5,000 Puerto Ricans had gone to Hawaii in 1900 through 1903 to work in a sugar plantation. And I'm like, oh my God, did they ever get to go back home?
So much of the book, the first half especially, is about coffee growing. Talk about the importance of coffee in Puerto Rican history for a moment.
during the time of my novel, Puerto Rican coffee was greatly esteemed throughout the world. It was served in fancy cafes and everywhere. The Pope drank it in the Vatican. And so for the island and for people who were fortunate enough to have a little land and grow some coffee, farmers like my farmers in my novel in the beginning, Raul Vega and Vicente Vega, they are able to support themselves by growing coffee. And then when the Americans come in and they invade Puerto Rico during the Spanish-American War, it just ruins the coffee industry in Puerto Rico because Americans don't drink Puerto Rican coffee. It's too strong.
You referenced the U.S. invasion in 1898. Puerto Rico had been a Spanish colony for centuries. What would you like people to understand about Puerto Rico's place as part of America, as part of the United States?
Well, Puerto Rico, at that time of the U.S. invasion, it was a colony. It only became a commonwealth in the 1950s. But I think what's important now is for Puerto Ricans here at this moment is to really understand that Puerto Rico is still a colony. It doesn't matter what fancy name you want to call it, it's still a colony. When you can't make your own, set your own laws for your own people, and you have to wait for the federal government to approve everything that you do. And what do I want people to know about Puerto Rico now is that Puerto Rico's a nation, its own nation with its own language and its own culture and its own people. It's not just a tourist attraction.
You note in the book frequently the legacy of slavery in Puerto Rico, which ended not too long before the events you focus on in the book, the legacy of racism there. I wondered why you chose to focus on that and why you think that's important.
For a lot of Puerto Ricans, we grow up with our families telling us, saying that they're not racist, that Puerto Ricans aren't racist. And I don't think that's true. And so I intentionally wrote about slavery in Puerto Rico and about colorism, how families talk about each other's color. So I went about doing it in as careful a way as I could because I am not a Black Puerto Rican. But I thought it was so important to bring up because if we don't pay attention to how we are complicit in racism and try to change how we think, then nothing will ever change.
That was Maricel Veda discussing her new novel, The Taste of Sugar, with 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Laura Satsui, Joya Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.